good evening, and welcome to another episode of the Homestretch Podcast with Adrian Durant. This evening, we have another special guest, Jamie Nieto.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Thanks for joining us. And Ashley, thanks for joining us again as well. For those of you just joining us, the Homestretch Podcast, where we talk to Olympic caliber, world championship caliber athletes, and we hear about their stories directly from them about how they achieve success and all the things they've had to overcome. So maybe we could take a little bit from their stories and apply it to our own lives. So, Jamie, I've been wanting to talk to you for a while. I think you have a very unique and special story, and I'm looking forward to getting into it. So Jamie was an Olympic high jumper, Pan Am silver medalist, 2004 and 2012 U.S. Olympic Trials champion, as well as a 2003 outdoor champion in the high jump with a personal best of 2.30 meters. I'm incorrect. He won USA's with 2.30 meters. Personal best is 2.34, 7 feet, 8 inches. Crazy. And he did that at the 2004 Olympic Games in Athens. So pretty cool, pretty cool. Jamie, welcome. Tell us how you got started in the sport.
Oh, yeah, that's a good story. So in 1993, I was a junior in high school, so I'm aging myself here. So I went out for the basketball team, and I had a bad grade in geometry. And at the time, if you had a bad grade and you were a junior, you couldn't play on the basketball team. It was like an automatic cut. So I got cut from the basketball team. I was pretty upset about it. And the previous year, I had played football and basketball. And I wanted to do another sport that year, but I didn't play football that year. I was like, I played football the year before, but it just wasn't me. I grew up in Sacramento, and it was really hot. And I just was like, yo, being out here with the coach yelling at me all day and burning up in this Sacramento heat is not fun. So I let football go and just thought I'd concentrate on basketball. Well, basketball then got cut, and so now I was like, well, what am I going to do? So a friend of mine said, hey, Jamie, why don't you come out for track and field? And I was like, nah, I don't like running at all. So and so he said, no, you can do, you know, different events. He said, you can try the high jump, work on your jumping ability, so the next year when you come back for basketball, you'll be dunking on everybody. I was like, oh, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So I did it, and I ended up making it to the state meet, California state meet. It was me and two girls, and I just said, man, I just fell in love with it. And I was like, this is what I want to do. I'm going to do this again next year. I had a blast, and I did, and continued on with it all the way through my career. So I started in 1993, and I retired in 2013. So I had a 20-year career in track and field.
That's a strong career. And and so from when you started in high school, it was all high jumps. So you weren't subject to 4x4s or any of that stuff?
Oh, yeah. No, I was. I wasn't. So I wasn't fast enough to where I was had to be subject to 4x4s. We had some pretty good sprinters on our team. But well, at least they were better than me anyways. But I did do the long jump, tried the long jump. I tried the triple jump. I tried the 300 hurdles. I tried the 800. Just kind of trying to feel my way around because, you know, when you're just getting started, you don't know what you are good at or what you could be good at. So I just thought, hey, somebody was like, hey, you should try the hurdles. You're tall and long. You probably do well. Okay, I'll try it. And, you know, I was like, oh, this is tough. You know, but I do feel like I had some skill in some of the other events. I just didn't have the love for the other events like I did for high jumping. High jumping just challenged me in a way that I really enjoyed.
And so you say you loved it. So at that point, did you start, when you were in high school and you were doing, you started getting better, did you start seeing a path to college and beyond that at any point?
Yeah, I did. That year when I first started, my friend who asked me to come out for the team, I knew he had been running track forever, you know, and for him, he didn't make the state meet. And I was like, man, this guy has been doing this all his life. And I just started this year and I made it to the biggest meet that I could, you know. And so I figured I had a talent and I knew that I wanted to do it the next year. And when I did it the next year, that's kind of when I started thinking, well, if I jump high enough, I could go to college or get a scholarship. And I did get some offers. That first year, my junior year, I jumped 6'4", which was, I just wanted to jump over my head, which I thought would be an amazing feat, which I'm 6'4 and a half. And then my senior year, I ended up jumping 6'9", and which quite wasn't high enough to get like a full ride scholarship to any place. But I got a lot of offers for D2 colleges. And I think some small D, no, I think they're mainly all D2. And I also got some offers for basketball because I played basketball again that my senior year. But I knew that if I wanted to be the best, I'd have to compete against the best. And I felt like the best were at the D1 colleges. So I thought, let me go to junior college, compete there for a couple of years, hopefully jump a little higher and then get a scholarship. And then hopefully that will help me to get to a university.
I'm glad you brought that up, the junior college, Ralph. I'm friends with another coach. His name is Barry Henry. He used to run a 400, and he often talks about that. You know, like, hey, JUCO. You look at all these folks who have been at the highest levels, and they didn't necessarily just come right out of high school and go D1. Some of them had to go to JUCO, and then they ended up going D1 or whatever else they ended up doing, and many of them ended up being very successful. Could you speak on that a little bit, going that JUCO route as an option for some of these kids?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it gave me another opportunity to jump a little bit higher. And I think also it gave me an opportunity to kind of really get my grades together, too, because it got to a point. I ended up going to junior college for 5 semesters, which is 2.5 years. And you're supposed to graduate in 2 years. I didn't have the best study habits, and my education, you know, my school was fine, but I just didn't apply myself. So when I got to junior college, I realized I had to apply myself, and especially if I want to chase and follow my dreams of competing at a D1 college, I had to be able to have an associate degree. So that would be the only way that you can transfer out of junior college to a university. So when I got to the junior college, it was a good eye opener for me because it helped me to really kind of establish good time management. You know, go wake up in the morning, go to school from, you know, I don't know, 8 to 12, and then go to study hall and work on the classes that I'm not good at for another 2 hours, or have lunch, then do that. And then go from there to track practice. And then from track practice, go to my little part-time job. You know, so I had like a full day schedule. Pretty much I was grinding, especially that last semester in college. It was like, I got to get out of here. I can't be stuck. And if I end up staying here in Sacramento, I don't think that I'm going to make it anywhere else. I think it'll be pretty much the end for me. I probably will get a 9-to-5 or I don't want to say dead, but maybe in jail. You know, I got a lot of friends that were like running the streets that I hung out with, that they went left and I went right, and I could have easily went left with them, you know?
No, absolutely. You know, you said you didn't apply yourself. And I often think about this when it comes to school, you know, because obviously there's a lot of emphasis on doing it a certain way, you know, doing this, going to college, yada, yada, yada. And yeah. I think in a lot of cases, especially when it comes in African American community, it's like, you know, is it that this individual isn't good at school, or is the way that school is presented to them and the way that learning is presented to them just not interesting? It's not something that, like, when you decided you needed to do it because you had another goal, you were able to do it. But when it was just school in itself, it was like, maybe it's not enough to grab your attention, or you just don't see any point in it. You know, I think we have to reexamine how we do school in some ways.
No, I think that's a very valid and good point. I had to be forced to learn how they wanted me to learn if I want to get to the goals that I want to get to. But you're absolutely right. Maybe, you know, the teachers weren't teaching me in a way that interests me or sparked my creativity and, you know, and knowledge and thirst for knowledge. So, yeah, I think you're 100% right. You know, I definitely think that could be an issue. But I also like to think, you know, there's two sides to that coin there, too. You know, I felt like I don't want to blame anybody, because I felt like I could have taken the time to do what I needed to do so I can get to where I needed to get to. And sometimes in life, that's what you got to do. You know, you might not want to work this 9 to 5 right now, but you're going to work this 9 to 5 so you can stack your money, so you can now put this away, so you can later on just start your own business or whatever it is you want to do. Sometimes you have to do what you have to do until you can do what you want to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I also heard that JUCO path can be tough too. You know, I heard plenty of stories of ramen noodles and Vienna sausages.
Yeah, of course. Definitely.
Did you go to JUCO on a full scholarship?
So junior college, I had to pay. That's just normal school like everybody else. And then when I went, I competed there. So once I did jump a little higher, I ended up going to the state meet in junior college twice. And I think I got second and third, respectively, each year. But I had jumped over 7 feet and 1/4 inch. And that's kind of what got some colleges interested in me. Once you kind of hit over that 7 feet mark, you know, people are starting to look at you a little bit more. So I started getting some more D1 opportunities. And but at the end of the day, it came down to Berkeley and Eastern Michigan. And Berkeley was not far. It's about 1.5-hour drive from Sacramento. So I felt like if I went to Berkeley, I would probably be home a lot and I wouldn't really get that away college experience, you know. And then looking at Eastern Michigan, they had a great business program. They had a great track tradition. Berkeley did too, but it also was away from everything that I had kind of grew up knowing, you know? Yeah. And not to mention, and this was also a big factor, is I went to school, like I said, 5 semesters. So when I graduated, it was the mid semester of college. So that meant I was going to be coming into my university in January, as opposed to most kids coming in the fall. So Eastern Michigan wanted me to come in January, but Berkeley wanted me to wait until the fall because their scholarships renew in the fall. So they didn't actually have any more scholarships, but Eastern Michigan did. So I ended up deciding to go to Eastern Michigan. And I think one of the other factors was my coach said, Jamie, you could go to Berkeley, to Cal Berkeley, and be a small fish in a big pond, or you can go to Eastern Michigan and be a big fish in a small pond. And I thought that was kind of enticing as well. Little did I know, once I got to Eastern Michigan, I was a very average fish in a big pond. Yeah.
What was that culture shock like? Because you were going from just JUCO, and then you're going around D1 athletes that are all talented. So what was that culture shock like?
Yeah, that was a big one. First of all, the weather, because growing up in California, the weather is sunny all the time.
You're spoiled.
Yeah, it was spoiled, right. And then, you know, going to Michigan, I remember I was going around checking in all my classes, and I went into this building, and it was snowing outside. And when I walked outside, it was like a blizzard. I couldn't see 2 feet in front of me. And I was like, I don't know what to do. So I just went back in that building and I was at and just waited for like 1 hour or so until the snow kind of subsided. So that was a big culture shock. And then, you know, competing with all these other people, like jumping 6'10" and 7 feet in junior college, you're one of the top guys. Well, when I got to Eastern Michigan, that was a very average jump. There's a lot of guys jumping 6'10" and 7 feet. So it was a adjustment of my mind. Like, yo, if you want to be like a top guy, you really got to step up your game. You know, like I thought I already did, but it's like, no, you got to take it to a whole nother level, which, you know, that took time for me to do too. Cause that first year I just did all right. I jumped 7.5 feet. I had a very small personal best. And then at the end of that year, I went to like a last chance meet because I'm like, well, my dreams is go to this D1 college and I'm not even making it into the NCAA meet. So I'm not even competing against the best people. That's where I'm supposed to be going. So I missed out on making it to the NCAAs. And we were in Tennessee. It was a last chance meet. And I remember turning to my coach and I said, next year, I'm going to do this. I said, I'm going to train hard. I'm going to lift every weight. I'm going to break the school record indoors and outdoors. I'm going to be an All-American and I'm going to jump some personal best. And he was like, yeah, okay, Jamie, I think you can do it. And in my mind, I was like, oh, he thinks I'm playing. Like I'm 100% serious. Like I was so dead serious. Like was so committed. And when I talked to him about it later, he was like, no, I thought you were for real. I was like, I said, because what I told you that it didn't, I didn't see that in your face. Your face said, yeah, like, okay, whatever, you know? But so I end up doing that. When I came back the next year, I went hard. Like, I did everything the coach asked me to do. I lifted every weight. I finally got on a solid weight training program, which I had never been on. You know, I had never really committed myself that way. I had just been kind of like getting stronger and messing around in the weight room and doing great track workouts and technical workouts, but not really committing myself in the weight room. And then once I committed myself in the weight room, that changed me from jumping 7 feet to that next year, I ended up jumping 7'4.5".
Nice.
And I gotta highlight that because that's the piece that I look for in all of these conversations. When I'm talking to all you super athletes, I'm like, okay, there's always a point where it's a decision. And I always highlight it. It's like, you were good. Yeah, you were good. And you could have been just that good and been complacent. But yeah, you're like, nah, you know what? I want something else. And so you decided, you're like, this is what I'm going to do. And then everything you did after that, all your choices pointed right at that decision. So whether it was making sure you committed to the weight room, got your diet together, it was like you made a decision, now you're living it. And I'm here, it's such a common theme in all successful athletes. It's like no matter how good they were, there was a point where they could have stayed where they were or get to that next level. Getting to that level took a commitment, a real commitment, more than they were already doing. So I love that you made that point.
Yeah, thank you.
Was that 7 foot, going back to when you first broke 7 feet, because I'm curious, was that like a big barrier? It has to be, like, you know, you're 6'11", it's like 7 feet.
Yeah. I mean, 6 feet is your first barrier. And I did that my first year. And I remember it like yesterday. I was like, I'm going to get to 7 feet. But I jumped 6 feet and I'm all the way at the end of the track. And my coach is all the way at the 100 finish line. And I run, I'm not even done with the competition. Like, I was so excited. I ran all the way over to the, and I'm like pointing up at the stand, 6 feet, 6 feet. I just jumped 6 feet. You know, like, I was so excited. He was like, yeah, go back over there and finish jumping. You know, I'm like, okay. So that was 6 feet. And then 7 feet, I was in junior college and I was at the state meet and it was a big time meet. You know, it's like, this is the meet. If you win this, you know, colleges are going to be looking at you. And I had some other guys who had already jumped 7 feet that year that I knew I was going up against. And they pushed me. And that really kind of, in my mind, let me know that I could be a big pressure, big meat competitor, you know. And everybody is not that. You know, you can have a lot of talented guys and a lot of talented, you know, girls or men and women, you know, that are great on a day-to-day at every track meet. But when we get to the nationals or the championships, it's something different. You know, they don't always have that mental capacity to take it to that next level. And that's when I really kind of found out, yo, I got second at the state meet and I jumped a personal best. I can compete at the high level at the big meets and I can turn it on when I need to, you know?
Yeah.
What do you think are some techniques that you use to help you get that mental capacity?
Well, visualization definitely was it. You know, I did a lot of visualization, not as much as I did later. I learned more about visualization later in my career, but I did visualization on the track. So like just seeing myself jump and clear the bar helped me out a lot. But I think also my coach, there was two things, you know. One, my coach, he always pushed me, you know. He wanted to, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this without being crass. He liked to talk a lot of trash to me, you know. And so I didn't want to hear his mouth, and I knew that I was good, and he knew that I was good. He was also very encouraging, too. And so those two things kind of helped to push me to that next level of being aggressive, I think, you know, and going out there, even though I was the nicest guy I could talk to, whatever, but when I'm on a high jump pit, I'm like, I'm going after it. Yes, this is a whole different guy, you know. It's interesting, you know, even later in my career, when I was making Olympic teams and stuff like that, like, I was a showman on the track, but then when you see me, you know, just sitting down, having lunch or dinner or on a plane or whatever, but I'm like, a totally different guy. And I've had a lot of people say that to me. They're like, oh man, I thought you were like arrogant and I thought you were this and that. And I'm like, why would you think that? And I don't know, because that persona just came out when I competed. It was like, I'm aggressive. I'm out here having fun. I'm putting on a show. Let's go. You know what I mean? And then when I'm at home, I'm just chilling, you know, or when I'm eating lunch, I'm just chilling, like, whatever, you know, like, I don't have no reason to be competitive with you right now, you know? So I think that had a lot to contribute to it. And also, you know, I think, which is another big, even deeper level, underlying thing that helped to bring that mentality is I also, and this took, well, let me see, I figured this out in when I was at Eastern Michigan, when I started jumping well, and the school newspaper came, they did an interview on me and they asked me, you know, why do you jump? You know, and I'm like thinking like, I had just jumped a PB and I was doing great. And I had this, you know, the school record and I was making it to the NCAAs. And he asked me that question. I just stopped and thought about it. I don't know if I've ever had that question asked to me before. Like, why do you high jump? And I think a lot of athletes don't really get that question. And if they have, they don't really know what their motivation is to high jump. But it came to me and it was like, so me and my mom can have a better life. And once that came out, like, tears just started fall. I was like, why am I crying? Like, what? Because that's when I knew. I was like, oh, this is the reason why I'm so hungry to do this. This is the reason why I'm pushing so hard. This is the reason why I'm so aggressive on the track, because I have to do something better for my life and my mom's, you know?
I think it's important to know what that is, you know, that motivation, what's driving you. I think a lot of times we're in it, but we don't really know why. You know, I think sometimes, especially with a sport like track, you know, I started in second grade and I stuck with it because I got good at it. As simple as that. Mm-hmm. I think when you're a kid and you don't know anything about yourself and you start doing things, and then you start getting good at something, you start getting praise and you're competent and you start building confidence. And then, you know, it's like, man, this is what I do. So at that point, you didn't really stop to think about why you were doing it. You're like, I'm good at this. This is who I am. And even when you competed, there are a lot of sprinters like that. You know, people think they're arrogant or whatever when you meet them. The nicest guys, quiet, kind of mild manner, even introverted in a lot of ways. But when they step on that line, it's an animal. And that just comes out. And that confidence and that competitive spirit comes out. So, that's interesting. Yeah, really. It's like your first time understanding why you were really doing it. That's a big moment.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Is it important for you to have like your own separate persona for the track and field life? Knowing that how mental it is like imperative to step outside yourself sometimes and just put on somebody else?
I think be just who you are. Whoever you are, if that's who you are, you put on this persona when you go on the track, then do that. If not, then don't. You know, whatever makes you happy is I think what you should do while you're out there. That's going to help you compete at your best level. That's what I found. And that's what I enjoyed. I like putting on a show. I like having fun. I like clapping. I like slapping hands with the fans. I like, you know what I mean? Like, I like that. I enjoy that. If you don't, and you're still okay to go out there and have fun and you're still having fun, then that's great. Do that. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. This is my experience and how I like to do what I did. You know what I mean? So yes. You don't need jump.
Okay.
So you cleared 7.4 and now so you're in college, you've hit this personal best, you made a commitment, you went from 7 feet to 7.4. So now what?
I went to the senior national championships, and that was like daunting. You know, it was like, oh shoot, I'm competing against the American record holder Charles Austin and some of these other big names that, like, you know, I never imagined competing against. Like, I've seen them and I've studied their tapes, and now they're like right here jumping next to me. You know, and I say tapes because we didn't have YouTube back then. You know, we had actual VHS tapes that you had to find. You had to go to the library, put it in the video, and then watch and rewind and fast forward. It was, you know, it's a whole different thing nowadays. But that was a daunting thing. And that was like 1998. And but it was good experience, you know. And I think, you know, this is another good point, is like, it takes time to be great. It takes time. Like, and I think a lot of times we don't give ourselves that time that we need to be able to achieve what we want to achieve. You know, like, Michael Jordan didn't grow up like they put a ball in his hand. Now he's dunking and he's the best guy ever. No, it took years of training and practice. And same thing with Kobe, same thing with Charles, same thing with any amazing athlete that you know, it's like I've lost and I've had more bad years than up years, but it was those up years that made everything worth it. I could have stopped a long time ago after losing five meets, but I didn't. You know what I mean? Because if I would have stopped, then I would have never got to where I needed to get to, you know? So it just takes time to get to a point in your career, you know, that's going to help take you to that next level. And so I had one more season at Eastern Michigan. And after that, jumping 7.5 and indoors, I was like, okay, my goal is to win the NCAAs. And I only had an indoor left. And so I was jumping really well. I think I jumped another personal best indoors, that jumped 7.5 1/4. And then, doing all the same training that I did the previous year, but trying to step it up a level too. And then I went to the NCAAs and I remember thinking, I'm going to win this thing. I'm like, Eastern Michigan is not a big school. It's not a Texas. It's not a Florida. It's not a USC kind of a school, but they're going to know my name, you know? And I went out there and I competed with the best. I competed and the two guys. So I ended up getting third, but I did jump another personal best of 7.6. And the two guys who beat me, one guy was from Texas and the other guy was from Arkansas. So they were big guys, or big schools as well. Yeah. And the guy who got second, he jumped the same height as me. He only beat me on misses. And the guy who won it from Texas, he had jumped the next height. So, you know, that when I did that, I started thinking like Olympic dreams, you know, like, I mean, I can make an Olympic team. If I jump 7.6 at the NCAAs, if I would have did that at the Olympic trials, I would probably be on the Olympic team, you know? So that's when I started getting that idea, like I can probably make an Olympic team, you know?
Yeah. You made an excellent point there on how much time it takes, and people don't often see the work. And I think that's one of the issues with the current social media, you know, generation. You see all the ups, you see the good stuff, you see the 7.6 jump, but you don't see the misses, the fouls, the no heights, you don't see the losses, all of that. And you don't see the struggle, you know, the stuff that you have to go through. That exists. And that's one of the purposes of this podcast, to let people know, hey, look, this stuff takes work. You know, it takes work. You want to win, you want to be good at something, anything, you're going to have a story, and it's going to be a journey and a trial, period. And there's no way to avoid it.
So you're
at the point now where you're like, okay, you know what? I can compete with the big dogs, you know?
Right.
So tell me about that path to the 04 games.
So it was a little bit up and down, no pun intended, but so I graduated college and I did the indoor season, graduated school, and then I had the outdoor season to compete for myself. So this was 1999. And then 2000 was Olympics, you know, and Olympic trials. And Olympic trials for the next two Olympic trials were going to be in Sacramento. So I was like, oh, shoot, I'm going home. I'm going to train at home and get prepared for this the trials for 2000. So I trained that 99 year, and it was tough because it's a big transition, you know, from having everything right there that's for you. You know, you got school, you got this regiment that you do every day. You go to practice, you come home, you got scholarship money and all that. So like it's all there. But once you graduate, it's not there anymore. You know, you're like at home. And I was like, what are you going to do now? So it was like figuring out that routine for myself to kind of get me back in that place of being on a normal training routine again, or normal like athlete routine, you know. But I had to get a job and, so I can get money for myself. And what else? You know, like I had to figure out where I'm going to train, who's going to be my coach, and, you know, all these different things. So that kind of took a toll on me. And I actually went from 7.6 the previous year, 1999, to only jumping 7.3 3/4 the next year. And I think a lot of it had to do with that transition. I eventually got a job at Home Depot, and it was an opportunity.
Shout out to Home Depot. A lot of athletes have been through the Home Depot.
Hey, I was in the paint department.
Yeah.
So you guys know, went to the Home Depot, and they had the Olympic Job Opportunity Program, which I heard about, but I wasn't able to get on it at first. So I was like, let me just get the job first and then see if I can get on the program later. And I did. So I was working in the parking lot for like 3 months, lifting cement and bricks and wood and like just, and then trying to go to practice later. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was tough. It was very tough. And then eventually, like I said, 3 months later, I eventually got on the program. And that made things way better. And then they moved me inside the store, and I was working as a cashier. So it helped out tremendously. So now I had a little money in my pocket, and I could train. And I didn't really have to worry about a lot of stuff. Still had worries, and because for whatever reason, the track at my junior college didn't want me to train there. And then Sac State, where the trials was going to be, they didn't want me to train there. I don't know if it's liabilities or whatever. So I was having kind of a tough time finding a place to train, you know, and I was kind of like all over the city. And then eventually my junior college was like, OK, we'll let you train here. And I think they let me be like a volunteer coach or something like that, that allowed me to be there on the track, but still had some issues. You know, like people would come out every once in a while, like, what are you doing here? Like, I'm training, you know. So, you know, like I said, that was a big transition. And I went to Olympic trials. And I end up getting fifth place, and I'm jumping the 7.3¾, that which was a season's best, and I got fifth place. And I was like, "Dang, you know, like, man, is it over? Like, well, I don't know. You know, I definitely want to keep training and competing, but it's like, am I ever going to get back to jumping the 7.6s again? You know, and higher?" And so that took some time, and so 2001. Again, I was trying to find my way and where am I going? And I found out about the Olympic Training Center in San Diego. And you know, to bring up a point too, is Sacramento, it rains a lot. So it'll rain all the way through April. So it's like, we don't have any indoor facilities out there. So it's like, I'm running, looking up, and it's raining in my face, and I can't jump over the bar with the rain in my eyes, you know? So that became an issue as well. So I found out about the Olympic Training Center in San Diego. And decided to move out there. I had some family in San Diego. I thought it was a good place to go. But then it was like finding another coach that I felt like I can grow with and learn a lot more about the high jump. And I found him, and he was in Kansas State University. And I found him through another athlete who was doing really well. I was like, yo, man, what are you doing? I need to know what you're doing so I can do that, because you're over here making teams and you're jumping out the gym. Like, what's going on? So. And he was gracious enough to let me come out there and train with his coach. You know, some athletes aren't like that, you know. Yeah. But he had an idea that, you know, if I can bring you out here and you get better as a high jump, it's going to make me better. Which is, you know, a lot of people don't look at it like that. You know,
steel sharpens steel, man.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So I ended up training with his coach, and things started getting a little bit better. I had a little more structure. And I was kind of back and forth from Kansas to San Diego. I had another coach in San Diego that just kind of watched me. And then I would fly out to Kansas to make sure my technique was right for like a couple weeks or a month or so, and then fly back. So I had that going on. And then eventually things started kind of picking up. And it took me about a year and a half. I think it was like 2002. Finally got another good jump. And I was like, okay. And I was trying to get overseas, because that's where all the best athletes compete. You know, I knew if I can get overseas that, you know, they would help me to jump higher, because they would be on another level and I would just have to make my jumping better anyways.
Yep. And that's where the money is. You can't forget that at this point, this is your job.
Right. Exactly. So I was looking for an agent. I had an agent when I came right out of college, but he wasn't quite right for me. And then I started like putting in some calls and some emails. And eventually I got myself into some meets in the Caribbean. Like, I think it might have been like Guadeloupe and Barbados. It was like two meets, and they're like, yeah, we'll take you. I got myself in myself with no agent, you know? And so I'm sitting there waiting to get my money after, because I think I got like second or something like that. So I'm waiting afterwards in the hotel where they're dispersing the money, which which only agents usually go there. You know, agents go, they put their name on this list, and then as the names kind of get crossed out, they go in one by one. I'm waiting, and I didn't see the list on the door, so I'm just like, I'm next. I'm going in next to get my money. And then an agent pops up, and he's like, you waiting on something? I'm like, yeah, I'm waiting to get my money. And they're like, your agent? So I was like, I don't have an agent. This guy happened to be Paul Doyle. And I don't know if you guys know who he is. He's a pretty big agent in the sport now. But he was just kind of starting out. He had a few athletes under his belt. He's like, look, man, I'll get your money for you if you want. He's like, there's a list here. And, you know, he explained everything to me. So I was like, all right, I'm waiting right here, though. Because I didn't.
You're not about to take my 20% on the way out.
Nope.
Mm-hmm. You jumped hard for that money.
I did. I did everything on my own. Like, I bought my own uniform. I got my, you know, booked my flight to get out there. You know, like, they paid for the flight, but, you know, I like did everything for the most part. But anyways, I talked to him, and I'd been talking to some agents, and they were selling me some dreams and stuff like that. But I talked to him, and he said, he was like, well, what's your goals? I was like, you know, I'm trying to make Olympic team. Right now, I'm trying to get overseas and compete over there. He was like, I can get you overseas. That's not a big deal. I was like, yeah, right. Sure. That's what everybody's been saying, but I haven't been going yet, you know? And so he's like, yeah. He was like, give me your contact information. And then that's when me and Paul linked up. And literally, he had three meets ready for me before I even went to the national championships. And prior to that, all the agents that I had been talking to were saying, you have to make the team first before I can send you overseas and go to any track until then. So, which that is basically them telling you, I don't want to work for you. You do all the work. And then once you have a name for yourself, then I can get you in all these meets. But the athletes don't always realize it's like, you don't really need the agent at that point in time to get yourself.
You made the team.
You've got on the team. And now they want you. Exactly. So, so he had already had me in three meets before I even went to my nationals to be on the team. So I was like, okay, well, this guy seems like a pretty good, and everything he's been saying he would do, he's been doing. So I stayed with him, and literally I was with Paul my whole career. We never even had a contract, never even signed a contract with him. Yeah. Hmm. And yeah, we're great friends to this day, but, yeah, so I went to the Nationals. I did a little better. I think I got fourth, jumped like 7-4, and I started feeling things are starting to come back. Then that summer, he got me in one big meet. I said, that's the meet I'm going to go, and I'm going to jump high at that meet. And it was like Linz in Austria. And it was a big – back then they were Grand Prix meets. It was a Grand Prix meet. Oh, yeah. And I was like, all right, that's going to be my championships for the year. That's the one I'm going to go hard at. And literally that's what I did, and I ended up jumping 7.6.5 again at that meet. I was like, all right, I'm getting back. It's ready. I'm getting ready to go now. You know, so that was 2002. And I just kind of rode that wave in 2003. And I know I'm taking a long time to get there. I'm sorry, but I'll get there quick. 2003, he had got me some meets indoors overseas, went over there, jumped well again. And then I'm like, yo, 2003 is about to be a good year. Well, it was May. So it was like a month before our nationals, I found out that my girlfriend was cheating on me. It broke my heart. It broke my heart. I was like devastated. And I was like, whoa, yeah. I lost weight. I was stressed. I was like, oh my God. And I'm like, right before the Nationals, like the Nationals were like we're about a month away, you know? But what it did was it like really got me focused. I was like, well, I don't have that distraction anymore. Now it's like all about tunnel vision. Like everything is like.
But that was after you went through all your stress, and then you're just like, okay, let me actually get focused because I'm hungry now.
Right. But I mean, I still was stressed. I still was like going through the heartbreak of it. But it was like I had nothing else to really focus on but track and field. So everything just got poured into track and field. And I went to the Nationals that year, and I was just a man on a mission. And I remember telling myself, I'm going to jump 7.6.5 on my first attempt. And I wasn't saying like, I'm going to win it. That was just my goal. I want to jump 7.6.5 on my first attempt. Well, I went there. I jumped 7.6.5 on my first attempt, and I ended up winning it.
Oh,
and
nice.
Making my first team, my first national team. You know, I started and I was 26 years old. So I started high jumping at 16 years old. 10 years later, 26 years old, I finally make my first team, which is the World Championships in 03, which were in Paris. And I went to Paris and I ended up getting, I think I got seventh or ninth. I think I got seventh at the World Championships, but it was my first opportunity at a major competition and to kind of get that experience. A lot of people don't realize you need that experience. That experience helps you later because the next year when I was going for the Olympic team, all those same people that were at the World Championships were going to be at the Olympic Games. Yep. It was like all those people who I competed against at the World Championships, they're going to be at the Olympic Games for the most part. So, yeah, preparing for 2004, which this ended up being the highlight of my career, was the Olympic trials in Sacramento again, came back home, and I was ready. I was, again, a man on a mission, and I ended up jumping a personal best of 7.7¾ and making the Olympic team and winning the Olympic trials. And then later that summer, went to Athens, Greece, and ended up jumping another personal best at the Olympic Games of 7'8" and placing fourth. Second, third, and fourth, we all jumped the same height. They just jumped it on their first attempt, and I jumped it on my second attempt. I actually was in medal contention the whole competition.
That's a crazy comp.
Yeah, literally to like a last jump kind of a thing, which the guy who, at the point in time who won it, he was in fourth, and then he cleared the bar. And then he cleared the next bar. And it was like, oh, what? Yeah. You know, it was like, oh, what's going on? You know, like I was in like, I think I was in like second place the whole time. And then we get to 7.8 and the American guy jumps in on his first attempt. He was like clean the whole day. And then this guy from the Czech Republic, he passed two attempts at 7.7, had one attempt left at 7.8 and clears it. I'm like, oh, great. I go, I miss. I go again. I clear it on my second attempt. The guy who ends up winning it, who was now in fourth, he goes, he misses his first attempt, misses his second attempt. Now it's like, oh, God, if anybody can clear this, it's this guy. But please, God, let him miss this. You know what I mean? Like, please. He goes, he clears it. And I'm like, oh, okay, it's okay. I'm still in third. No big deal. First attempt at the next bar, which was 7.8¾. Those other two guys miss. The guy who just made it on his third attempt bangs it and clears it on his first attempt. I was like, oh.
Man.
Oh, God.
I think the most interesting thing that a lot of people miss with field events is how one moment, one jump could change everything. And it's everything. On both sides, from the spectator perspective, is like, oh, you're in that suspense. And at any moment, one of these people who are in sixth can just jump one and then they're automatically in first. And then from the athlete's perspective is like, you have to watch all these guys do it. And then you're starting to be like, oh, man, he just made it. Okay, I got to try to make it. And then that could either be good and you'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm getting it. Or it could be like, oh, damn. Like, this person just did this. Like, can I do it? Then you start having those little subtle doubts. Yeah. So it's interesting watching the field events. Because when you're running, listen, gun goes off and it's done. You just see what happens there. The field events, you get over and over. You never know. And then I even know the last two long jump major competitions, like on the last jump was medal contenders. You could have been in first the whole entire time. And then I think one time Tiana just like jumped almost out the pit.
Yeah.
Got a medal.
It ain't over till it's over.
Yeah. And then the other girl from Nigeria who was trailing the whole entire time, pops 7 meters, gets a medal. Yeah. And it's just like, it just happened out of nowhere. I think we miss that with field events. Like we often look at folks on the track events, everything's about track events, but the show is on the field event. That one
right, right. Which really gets me upset about NBC coverage. Because it's like, all they do is show the highlights. And I'm like, I want to see the jumps from jump to jump to jump to jump. Like, I want to see the, you know, like, and, but anyways, that's another gripe.
Like, by the way, that's one thing I don't like. But also, now they try to make it a little bit better. So at least we have those channels now. So we can watch it if that's what we want.
Well, especially with Eurosport helps a lot, but like we're watching the Olympic trials right now and we have to just deal with whatever they show us. You know, it's like they have certain apps, we don't have cable, so I'm getting mine through a streaming service, you know, so that shows NBC. So I can only watch what they show me. You know, other than that, I wouldn't really be watching normal TV, you know?
Yeah.
So, I wish they had an actual, like, website where you could just watch. Because once Eurosports, I have an app that will show me Eurosports. So once Olympics come around, I can watch that. But that's just the Olympic trials is just frustrating. And I'm a little frustrated right now because I've been watching it and I want to see more and I can't, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I get you on YouTube.
Yeah, I have been. I've been going back and watching stuff on YouTube.
Okay.
So I want to fast forward a little bit because if not, I'll probably have you on here for 3 hours, man, because there's so many different pieces of your story. You know, right. I mean, we're just at the first Olympics. You ended up going back in 08.
Right.
You went back in 2012 and you had to deal with foot injury that you had to recover from. And so I think, you know, your story is this is how it is. You know, it's always ups and downs. It's never like it goes through smoothly, you're the best and you win. It's like life is always, you know, ebbs and flows. And even when you're at your highest, you can hit a low point and you still got to figure it out. And so I want to transition let's move forward to 2016.
Okay.
But briefly, because we did interview your wife, Siobhan, and we didn't give her a shout out yet, but I think you met Siobhan around, when was it? Was it 2012-ish?
I met Siobhan in 2010, at a commercial audition. And, I just walked by and I was like, I think she runs track. She looks familiar. Like I've seen her before, but I've never talked to her. I didn't know her. So I just said hello and I was going to try to talk to her, but she seemed really focused. So I just I felt like she was kind of giving me the cold shoulder a little bit. So I was like, let me leave her alone. Good luck. You know, and I just like end up leaving and, you know, maybe I should have been more focused because she ended up booking a commercial and I did. So, but anyways, and then fast forward 2 years later, which was 2012, you know, I was getting more into my acting, writing, and producing. And I was producing this series called Blood Brothers. It was a crime drama. And I was raising money on a GoFundMe to like shoot it and stuff like that. And so I was reaching out to all my friends and I reached out to her and she ended up donating to the show and helping me to, you know, make the show. But that's kind of how we end up reconnecting in 2012. And then I saw her at a track meet. I was like, yo, thanks again for donating. Here's my trailer that we shot. You know, this is where your money went to. She's like, oh, thanks. And she really liked it. She was like, hey, did you show everybody else? I was like, well, no, not really. And then she like took my phone and ran around and then showed everybody. She's like, you see this? I was like, oh, God. So that was the reconnection. And then we went to Jamaica. I think we were in Guadeloupe and then we went to Jamaica and competed there. And then we just talked some more. And I was like, hey, well, you know, what's the next meet you're going to? And she said, I'm going to UCLA. I said, oh, I'm going to that meet too. You know, maybe afterwards we can get lunch. And she said, yeah. And ever since then, we were together.
I shoot your shot.
Yeah, you got shot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And you started with food. Well, you ended with food. So that always gets us.
Yeah. But just to let you know, so I made the team in 2004, 2008, which is another long story. I ended up missing out on the team. And then 2012 coming back when I was 35 years old and at the end of my career dealing with a foot injury, making the Olympic team and winning the Olympic trials again. And so that's what happened there. I think you said I made the 08 team, but I didn't make the 08 team. There was a gray area. So my wife says, yes, I made the 08 team, but I guess officially I didn't make the Olympic team, but I guess officially I should have been on the team. But I'll briefly touch on it. Mm-hmm. They instated a new rule, which was saying, if you don't have the A standard by the Olympic trials, no matter what you do, you can't make the team. Usually there's two rules to get to the Olympics. It's placing in the top three and having that Olympic A standard. And then after the trials, there's usually a month where you can chase the standard, right? The rest of the world had that month to chase the standard. That particular year, 2008, they said nobody's going to be able to chase the standard if you don't have it by the Olympic trials. It's pretty much over. And so they didn't send that message out till beginning of June. And so when I went to the trials, I ended up placing second. I didn't have the standard, but then 6 days later, I ended up jumping the standard. Yeah. So I ended up doing the arbitration, which is like a court hearing. And I ended up losing the arbitration and not being placed on a team. But and I think the guy who ended up getting seventh place at the Olympic trials ended up going to the Olympic Games. So that was a very disheartening year for me. But again, you know, it's those ebbs and flows. And in that year is when I decided to take an acting class, and I kind of got into acting, and it kind of helped me to figure out this other trajectory that I was going to go after I was done with track and field.
Yeah, I do want to go into that because you do a lot. You definitely do a lot. You know, you're producing shows and you're writing, you know, you're writing. And so there's definitely a lot I want to go into. But take us into, you know, I know this was a big year, 2016, a dramatic change in your life.
Yeah.
I'll let you tell the story. I won't even.
Okay. Yeah. So I retired in 2013 and I moved out to LA, and me and Siobhan were getting closer and started coaching. I was volunteer coaching at UCLA in 2014. And then 2015, I got a job at USC and was coaching there. And then kind of realized that like college coaching wasn't really what I wanted to do. So I started doing some, I was already doing post-collegiate athletes. I started sticking with my post-collegiate athletes. And one day in 2016, while we were training, we were doing some drills. And after my competitions, I always did like a backflip to celebrate. And this particular day, we were doing some somersaults. And I did a backflip, and I was like, you know, I did it, put it on my camera, and I think I was going to post it on Instagram or something like that. I was like, let me just do one more. And I was on some AstroTurf thinking, oh, at least I won't hurt myself if I'm on AstroTurf. And I go to push up, and one of my foot slipped, you know, my foot slipped, and I basically went up and went from my feet to my head, and then my body just kind of toppled over the rest of myself. And at that point in time, I couldn't move anything. And I thought, oh my God, I hope I'm not paralyzed. And the first thing that really kind of, maybe that was the second thought. The first thing that came to my head was, don't worry, you'll be okay. You just got to go through this. And I felt like that was God telling me, this is going to be a big thing in your life right now. And you got to go through this because there's some lessons you need to learn. And so then like my life kind of just started, as I'm laying there on the ground, my life just kind of started flashing before my eyes. And so I'm thinking about, you know, my life as a kid, the drama I went through. I'm thinking about like all these different people who had neck injuries or broke their neck or was paralyzed and really came back, and all these different random just thoughts are going through my head. And as I'm laying there, the athletes are like, they're kind of still kind of doing whatever. And I like had to turn to one of them. I was like, I can barely talk, because whenever you have a spinal injury, like it affects your diaphragm. So I was like at a whisper, and I was like, call 911, I'm hurt really bad. And they did. And, you know, I just asked them to pray for me right there. And eventually the ambulance came, and I was medevaced. They put me on a helicopter and flew me to the hospital. And I thought I was possibly going to die. You know, like I had no idea. Like within a split second, I'm in the hospital. And, you know, Siobhan at the time, she was my girlfriend, and she was still training and competing. And I was thinking about, we talked about marriage a little bit, and I was thinking about after the Olympics for her to propose. You know, I like started saving some money to get a ring and everything. And then I got injured. And so now I'm in the hospital, and I'm like, man, I'm going to get out of this, right? And I was praying, and I felt like God said, I'm going to make 100% recovery. I just got to go through this and learn these lessons. And so the doctor ended up saying that the disc in my neck slipped and bruised my spinal cord between C3 and C4, which left me paralyzed from the chest down. And so they went in and they put the disc back in place and fused C3 and C4. And then after that, it was just a recovery process. And, you know, we were like asking the doctor, you know, what's going to happen. The doctor said he should get about 30% functionality back, which is like what is that? Like, does that mean I'm going to be able to feed myself? Like, what is that? Like, I had no idea. And that definitely was not walking again. And so me and Siobhan, being just God-fearing people, you know, prayed about it. And we felt like God is telling us that I'm going to make a full recovery. And it might take some time, but it's going to happen. So, we just stayed positive, and whatever the doctor said, it didn't really matter because we had our own thoughts and ideas of what was going to happen. And so I was in the hospital for about 2 months. I was in ICU for 2 weeks, and then I got transferred to a rehabilitation hospital. And I was there for a couple months, just rehabbing and trying to get back. And by the end of 2016, I was starting to stand up, and they had actually sent me home with a power wheelchair, and I started using a walker by the end of the year. And so the whole year of 2017, let me back up, when I was in the hospital, I was talking to Siobhan, and I said, you know, like, after this happened, it was like I had all these thoughts, like how precious life really can be, and how we take so many things for granted, like getting up, washing our face, brushing it, all that stuff that we do on a normal, everyday, mundane basis. Like, none of that stuff is guaranteed. Like, I couldn't even scratch my face. I couldn't wipe something off my eyebrow because I couldn't move anything. Like, and you don't realize, you know, like how privileged that is, how much of a privilege that is, until you don't have it anymore. And so me thinking about, like, tomorrow's not promised, I told Siobhan, I said, hey, if you want, I'm ready to get married right now. And she said, no, let's wait till you get back on your feet and we can talk about it then. And I was like, all right. And that was like, again, like that moment when I was talking to the coach and I was like, look, I'm gonna lift all the weights and I'm gonna get back and I'm gonna break the record. Like, I was like, okay, like, I'm gonna get back on my feet and we're gonna talk about this again, you know? And we did. And, you know, like, so I think when I got home at the end of 2016, a couple months went by. And like I said, I started getting up and using the walker and stuff. And we started looking for rings and stuff like that. And then we decided to make a date of July to get married. And I said, well, my goal is to walk you down the aisle. So that's what I'm going to do. And at the time, I was barely, like, trying to take three steps. Like, I wasn't even taking three steps. I was kind of like falling over three steps, you know, like I was barely trying to catch myself. Well, those three steps, I said, I think it'll take probably about 150 steps to get out of church. So she was like, okay, so now my new goal is July. And I'm starting to think about it from a training aspect of an Olympic training aspect. Like, my Olympics is July. Let me plan back. This is going to be my base. I'm going to train and I'm relaxing and I'm rest, recover, and get ready for this wedding. And this is exactly what I did. So at the beginning of the year, I was taking three steps, and a couple weeks later, those three steps turned into six steps, and then those six steps turned into 12 and then 25. And then next thing you know, we're like a month away from July, and I did it, and I took 156 steps. And I told Siobhan, I was like, I did it. I took 156 steps. And she was like, oh, that's great. I'll do 200.
Okay. Yeah.
And so by the time the wedding came around, I ended up taking like 206 steps. And, you know, it was like national coverage. We had the LA Times. We had Associated Press. We had Sport ESPN. We had like all these different media outlets covering the wedding. And Siobhan, being a singer, she ended up singing down the aisle, and you know, and that was beautiful. And I couldn't really look, and I just stood there. I couldn't really look because I was gonna cry. And if I cried, then I wouldn't be able to see, then I'd probably fall. And I didn't want all that to happen, so I just kind of like just smiled and tried to look away. But it was such a beautiful moment, and I was able to make good on that promise and walk her out of the church and into the limo, which was a true blessing. And yeah. And then since then, I'm still doing recovery and still doing rehabbing and working out. So by the end of 2017, going into 2018, I started using forearm crutches. And then 2019, I started using a quad cane. And so then 2020 happened, and we had this pandemic, but moving kind of fast. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, now I'm at home, you know, on a normal basis. And when I'm at home, I usually kind of use a walker and have a tray so I can like put stuff on a tray and get from place to place or whatever. And so I kind of went back to using the walker again. And then I was like, because we were just in the house, we weren't really doing anything. And I was rehabbing in the house, but I wasn't like going out anywhere. And then as 2021 started coming up, I was like, I need to get back on my goal because I plan to run again. Like I need to get back on free walking. And so I made a conscious goal this year to just start free walking around the house. And that's what I do. So, you know, in the morning, I might use a walker to use the bathroom or whatever. But then after that, I place it to the side and I walk into the kitchen. I take little half steps and I stay close to the wall, but I'm doing it and it's getting better and better. And so I've been doing that now, you know, all this year. So it's this June, you know, so it's half a year. Yeah. Yeah. God is good. And so
God is good.
I'm getting better and better every day. And and so I will run again, you know, so you'll be able to look back at this when you see my documentary one day and see me running. You'll be like, oh, he said that on my podcast, man.
Oh, well, I believe it, man. I I've seen enough from people who've decided to do something, you know, once your mind is set, you know, I've seen people pull things off. I mean, your whole story, you know, it's every step, 6 feet, 7 feet, 7'6", you know, it's, you're setting goals and you're pursuing them. And it's inspiring because, you know, as we're going through this life, you know, sometimes you feel beat up, you know, you feel overwhelmed. You could have given up. I'm happy that, you know, you had a support system and Siobhan was there. Cause I mean, that's a special person, you know, to support you through that for sure. And just to be there every step of the way, pushing you as well, not just supporting you, but not coddling you, though, pushing you like, hey, look, get those 200 steps. Like, I don't want to hear any of this stuff. Like, and I'm like, man, that's real. You know, that's real. But it's definitely inspirational, man. And we do take things for granted. And I hope just hearing this story, folks are just thinking about their own lives and realizing the things that they have every day that we just kind of don't even appreciate how special it is. Being able to jump, right? You know,
that's right.
Thing. But also knowing that no matter where we're at, that there's something that we can do, you know, that it's here. And if we're focused and we set a goal, you can actively work towards that goal. And it'll put you in a state where, I mean, I'm sure that competitiveness kept you going. You know, you're like, I'm getting this next step. I'm getting this next step. And it's like something to aim for, you know?
100%. What were you going to say, Ashley, before I go into it?
Well, first, I have two parts now that we went on. So the first part was that, was there any time when you thought that, okay, this is the love of your life, but did you ever feel like I might potentially lose her? And was that like a motivation to just keep going? And then the second question is, you see how you have that athlete mindset? Do you think that is important to, for, you know, the average person to understand that being an athlete is not only just like being the highest person, having the highest performance in a certain skill, but it's also mindset, and it helps you to achieve those goals because you could apply those same characteristics to walking again after you being paralyzed.
Correct. Yeah, no, those are great questions. And I was actually going to touch on that before you asked, and I'll answer the second one first. When I got injured, you know, like I started back at zero, just like everybody else, everybody who gets injured and has a spinal injury, like, you know, after you're laying in bed for 3 days with no movement, your muscles start to atrophy. You start losing strength. And I was in bed for 2 weeks. You know, I didn't sit up, like, you know, and try to stand up for a month, I think it was, you know. So I started back at zero, just like everybody else did, everybody who's had a spinal injury. And I was in great shape before I got injured. And I don't think me being in great shape helped me, because I was still training like 3 days a week. I was still lifting weights. I was still running and stuff like that, you know, so I was in good shape before I got injured. And I don't think that really helped me much. What helped me is what you're exactly saying is the mentality that I have, the mentality of saying, I'm not going to accept this. I'm going to push for more and I can do this. You know, I said it in an interview. I said, I'm going to walk again. I'm going to run again. I have the fight of an Olympian, the fight of an Olympian. Like, I have more in my mind that it takes to do normal things that most people have, you know? And so just having that first of all, faith in God. And then second of all, just having that determination and then that will to want to do more and know that I can do more, even when people discourage me and tell me that I couldn't. That's what helped to get me back on my feet. And then, yeah. And then the other part of your question is like, yeah, I was in the hospital. And there was a point in time where I was like, you know, Siobhan didn't have to stay with me. She could have left. She could have. And I knew that was a real possibility. I didn't want her to leave, obviously, but, you know, it was a decision that she had to make on her own. And, you know, I didn't want to hold her back in any way, shape, form, possible. You know, like, I was sad that this had happened and it caused a chain reaction for her to forego trying to make an Olympic team or third Olympic team and just stay at home and take care of me. Like, I was sad that, like, I was happy, but I was also sad that, like, she had to give up her career to do this. I know she wanted to. This is what she wanted to do. And I'm so grateful and happy for that. But that's a very big step, you know, to say I'm not going to pursue this career that I've been pursuing my whole life, and now I'm just going to stay at home and take care of this guy, you know. And so I knew at that point in time, you know, that it's a real possibility. And there was my roommate in the rehab facility, like, he had a girlfriend and she left him, you know. And I heard a lot of stories about, you know, people getting injured and their significant others moving on, you know, like, they don't want to take on that responsibility because it is a big responsibility, you know. Like I said, like, you know, when you got to do everything for a person, you know, help them use the bathroom, help them get up, help them do this, it's a lot of wear and tear on a person. Thank God I'm, like, recovering and I'm able to back to doing those things, you know, on my own. But I couldn't do them on my own at first, you know. I was at zero, like everybody else. So brings me to this other point is, you know, as I was recovering and I finally got back home, I told Siobhan, I said, I understand what you did was a big, big choice. And I know that your other love and your other passion is music. And I want to do everything that I can to help you pursue that goal and that dream of being a singer again. And so she got inspired by me, like, trying to get back on my feet and do the things I did. She started writing songs. And one of the songs that she wrote was for me, and it was called Through the Good and the Bad. And I thought that was just a beautiful song. And I told her, I said, I think because of how things are going, like, we should release this song and we should do a music video for it. And I said, I'll produce it. So that kind of got me back to doing something that I love to do. Like, I was already starting to get back to writing and stuff like that. And I had found an agent that, you know, would represent me for my acting and stuff. But I was like, I hadn't really produced anything in a little while. So I produced her music video and it came out great. And we were, like, elated about it. And 2 months later, after, you know, it kind of being out there, some people from America's Got Talent saw it and asked her to be on the show. And so she was on last season of America's Got Talent. And it was amazing. She did an amazing job. And the judges loved her. And she sang our song, Through the Good and the Bad. And it just made for an amazing story. So if you haven't seen it, you know, it's you can find it on YouTube. You know, you can just type Siobhan Music. You can see the music video and you can see her performance on America's Got Talent. And I definitely encourage everybody to go check that out. And the Sports Center feature, we got a lot of stuff kind of going on. So Sports Center feature kind of is like a mini documentary about what happened and who we are. So that gives you a lot of insight on our story. So
is this, if I wasn't trying to cry before, you definitely were almost getting it out of me. So we can go on to the good stuff. What's happening in your life now? I know Siobhan is having an amazing career, but as far as producing and everything, how is that going?
Oh, it's going great. So, you know, since the pandemic, so a little rewind, last year, 2020, getting my years confused since we've already had this, like, whole pandemic. So at the end of 2019, Siobhan got pregnant, right? And so definitely a huge blessing. We were so excited. So being on America's Got Talent, she made that announcement. She was 4 months pregnant at the time while she was on stage singing. And I had just did, at that point in time, I just did a TV show called Away, which was a sci-fi on Netflix starring Hilary Swank and a guy named Josh Charles. And I was in, I think, 3 or 4 episodes of that show. And you can watch it on Netflix now. But so we were doing those things. And then the pandemic happened. And after the first round of Siobhan's audition for America's Got Talent, and the show didn't know what they were going to do. So they were thinking, you know, they're going to do things online. And then they decided, oh, no, we got to do this in person. So they ended up having all the contestants go to Vegas. And we just felt like it's too much with Siobhan being pregnant. We don't want to take the chance of her getting sick, anything happening to the baby. So we decided to forego the rest of America's Got Talent. So when people look and they're like, well, what happened to her? She did so great the first round. Well, yeah, she did. And she probably would have did a lot better, but, you know, continuing on. But, you know, God has a way of, you know, doing things the way they're supposed to be done. So, you know, we decided to just focus on our family, and she ended up having the baby in August of last year. And now it was a boy. His name is Jaysha. And he's 10 months old now, and I'm so happy. I just had my first Father's Day the other day, which was beautiful.
Congratulations, yeah. Man.
Thank you.
I keep seeing pictures. I'm like, man, kids getting older and older. Like, I saw pictures when, you know, baby was born, and like now, like full head of hair, getting big. Like,
yeah, he's like running around and talking. Well, he's not talking quite, he's babbling a lot, but he's like, blah, 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 blah. You're like, but it's such a blessing. You know, like I said, I cherish every moment. And I think about the day that I got hurt and how, like, tomorrow's not promised. So it's like, you know, being at home and being in this quarantine has been great because I've been able to spend a lot of time with my family and my new baby. And, you know, and just cherishing those moments has been amazing. It's been great. It's been so such a blessing. But other than that, you know, I've been writing a lot. Towards the end, which was like a couple months ago, I decided a friend of mine came to me and wanted to produce a reality show. So I helped him produce a barbershop reality talk show.
You're going to talk about it? I heard a new show you're producing. Cut to It?
It's called Cut to It, yeah. And, so we're in the process of trying to sell it now. So it's nothing that I've put out yet, but, you know, God willing, I think it's a great show. It's a great concept, and everybody who's seen the trailer seemed to really enjoy it. And I think
I saw the trailer. There for it. It was good.
Thank you. Did you like it?
I did. I mean, you know, the barbershop is where most real conversations happen for men. So it's, you know, yeah, I like it. Sure.
Great. Thank you. So it was fun to produce that and just kind of be back. And, you know, we were also very safe. You know, we made sure that everybody had their mask and got COVID tests and all that stuff. So, yeah. But that was fun. So, like I said, we're in the process of pitching that. Now I'm still auditioning. I get auditions from my agent every once in a while, but they're all online, so I don't really have to worry about going anywhere. Still writing, just kind of finishing up a sitcom that I wrote. And, what else? Still,
you have a children's book. Didn't you write a children's book?
I did write a children's book a while ago, and I'm not quite sure when I'm going to bring that out yet, but I've been tweaking the story a little bit here and there just to make sure it's what I want. But yeah, have a children's book. I wrote my autobiography.
Yeah.
I think it was 2017. And, you know, we're in talks of you know, doing a book, a joint book with me and Siobhan together.
So. Doing a lot, man. You're doing a lot. Yeah. And what else? And then also you guys have the foundation, the Helping
Right
Foundation. Tell us about that.
Correct. So yeah, helpingotherstriumph.com. I'm sorry, .org, helpingotherstriumph.org is the website. And that the way that came about, obviously, is because of my injury. After I got injured in 2016, you know, I didn't realize how many people's lives I actually touched through my career and just through my life. And we raised some money to help kind of get me back on my feet. And we ended up having, like, people donate from around the world. You know, we ended up raising $100,000 to kind of go back to my rehab and get me back on my feet, which helped tremendously. And so we thought, you know, we want to be able to provide that for somebody else. You know, not everybody has that support like I did. And so we created the foundation to help people with neurological issues and spinal cord injuries to help get them rehab and get back on their feet. So every, you know, so, you know, with my wife's music, you can download her song and buy that. But then with part of those proceeds go to the foundation, which ends up helping another patient or who's injured themselves and trying to get back on their feet. So that's what the foundation is all about. And it's, like I said, helpingotherstriumph.org. It's H-O-T. That's hot. So you guys check it out.
Yeah, I'll definitely put the link in the description so folks can go check it out. Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Man, well, Jamie, you have a great story. It's very inspiring. You know, it's real. It's like what life is, you know, it's like ups and downs and you could accept it or you can, you know, choose your own path and make decisions and push forward. And that's what you've done. That's what you've shown. You haven't let anything stop you. You know, even now you're doing more than, I mean, even with everything that's happened, you're doing way more than, you know, I'm just writing for a sitcom. Children's book, autobiography. Meanwhile, the foundation. I mean, this is impressive, man. It's motivating. It's inspiring me. I'm sure it's inspiring others, man. For sure.
Yeah, thank you.
One last thought. Do you think that without the injury, you could have seen yourself being this successful?
Well, I think with the injury, I think it's brought a lot of perspective to me. And I do think I would still have been going after my goals and dreams no matter what, just because I have that Olympic fight, that Olympic mentality. But I do think that the injury has opened up doors for me, and it's also allowed me to look at life a little differently. You know, so, you know, I definitely feel like I've been blessed, even though I've had this test. Mm-hmm. You know, and they say without the test, there's no testimony, right?
Mm-hmm. And there's no triumph. And I ask that because I feel like a lot of people choose to give up when they are faced with, you know, a real low point in their life, not even if they have to be paralyzed, but it could be something more, more simple, but they feel like it's the end of the world at that point. So I'm glad that we were able to hear your story because it shows like, you could be like your whole, a moment can change your whole entire life. That is true, but it doesn't have to end your life. Right. And then you are the only person that defines it at the end of the day. So I'm glad that you know, chose to define yourself more than just like your injury.
Yes. Yes, thank you.
You're correct. We see those stories all the time, right? Like doctors saying you're never going to walk, or this is never going to happen again. It's you know, I had a family member diagnosed with cancer, and they're like, "Oh, you should definitely do chemo or else." And you know, and people beat these things and overcome these things, and it's like people look at it, it's a miracle, but it's right. Not just a random miracle. This is a person who has made a decision, who has have some resolve, who's decided to make something happen. And the human body is an amazing thing, man. I think once you put your mind to certain things, a lot of things are possible. So,
man. Definitely.
Yeah, I don't want to hear no one can watch this and complain. I don't want to hear no one complain about giving up at anything.
Right. I'll tell you a quick little story about the power of the mind. You know, like when I was in the hospital, like my hands and my fingers were not moving. I could kind of shrug my shoulders, but that was about it. And so every day for like 2 weeks, I would wake up in the morning and I would do mental exercises. Like I was squeezing my hands every morning, like squeeze them, open them, close them, open, close them, open, close. They weren't moving at all. They were just flat. In my mind, they were moving. I was squeezing them and I was opening them and I was squeezing them open. And then after 2 weeks, my fingers started moving, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, like 7 of the 10 fingers started moving. Then by the couple more days later, then all 10 fingers moved. And then I was able to squeeze and open my hands again. You know, the power of the mind. Like I could have just sat there and just did nothing. And I probably would still be sitting there doing nothing.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jamie. I appreciate you coming on and talking to us. It's been great.
One last time, can you say your Instagram, where we can find you and Siobhan, and also the foundation?
Oh, yes. So you can find me on Instagram, all the social sites at Jamie Nieto. You can find my wife. I think she's had some issues trying to change her Siobhan Stoddard. That was her maiden name to Nieto. For some reason, Instagram is not allowing her to change it over for whatever reason. But so you can find her at either Siobhan Stoddard. I think you can even type in Siobhan Nieto and it will also come up. And then the foundation is helpingothers triumph.org. So you can definitely go there, contribute to that, make sure you get her song Through the Good and the Bad. And just continue to follow us and follow our journey. I mean, we still have a lot more to come. You know, we're doing a lot of things, like you said. So,
yeah. Hey, keep it going, man.
We will.
Yeah, congrats on everything, and thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you again. I wish you guys all the best on your podcast.
Thank you.
Wish you the best as well. Thank you. Have a good night. Have a good evening.
You too. Thank you.